Let's start in Acts chapter 4 tonight. This is an unusual Sunday in that all three preachers have or will have had a turn before the day ends. It reminds me of one preacher who was leaving a congregation. He had been there a long time, fairly long. And they had a going away get together for him. There was one of the old members, been there for much longer than him. And she was really upset, crying. And he tried to comfort her and he said, you know, I believe it's the best thing for me to move on, but you'll get someone else to preach here. And I'm sure that he's going to be better, even better than me. And she said, that's what they keep saying, but they keep getting worse and worse. And maybe by the end of tonight, you're going to understand what she means. They keep getting worse and worse. You know, there are certain characteristics that we associate with certain Bible characters. That's a predominant idea that's associated with their character or their experience. For instance, when I say Abraham, you think of faith. When I say Job, you may think of patience. When I say Samson, you think of strength. When I say Solomon, you think of wisdom. When I say David, you may think man after God's own heart. I think of Peter, you may think of fickleness, or Paul, dependability. So we have these ideas that we associate with certain Bible characters and lessons that we have learned both positively and negatively from the Bible record of their lives. Tonight I want to bring up a name and see what immediately comes to your mind, the name Barnabas. It is most likely that you immediately think of the word encouragement because Barnabas is the Bible's encourager. We are introduced to him in Acts chapter 4. William Ward wrote, "Flatter me, and I might not believe you. Criticize me, and I might not like you. Ignore me, and I might not remember you. But encourage me, and I will never forget you." Probably there's someone in your past that has made an indelible mark upon your character and your memory because of the encouragement that they were to you, maybe at a dark time, a difficult time, maybe just at a time in your life when you were developing in your childhood. It may have been a Bible teacher that really made an impression on you and took a special interest in you. It could have been a teacher from school. It may have been a parent, it may have been an elder or someone in the congregation, or just a friend, but someone who made a difference because they looked outside of themselves and they thought, how can I help this person? How can I help you? How can I encourage you? I want us to be that kind of a congregation. I want each one of us not only to have those kind of people in our lives that encourage us and help it to be easier for us to go to heaven, but that we also look outside of ourselves to see those who need encouragement, that we might be a Barnabas too. And so the homework from this sermon tonight, I'll just give it at the beginning, is this week, find someone to be a Barnabas too. Now let's figure out what that means based on the record of Barnabas in the book of Acts. Here is a man whose name is found 29 times in the New Testament. That's far more than most of the minor characters of the Bible, of the New Testament. We probably would associate Barnabas as being one of the more minor characters of the New Testament. He wasn't an apostle. There's no book in the New Testament addressed to him that bears his name. He was not a man who was well known as a great orator or preacher like Apollos. But Barnabas was a man, if you count the pronouns, who's mentioned almost 50 times in the New Testament. Interestingly, there's not a single word that Barnabas ever said that's written in the Bible. Now, we know that he exhorted others. We know he was an encourager with his speech or with his words, but we don't have any of his words recorded in the New Testament. But oh, what an example he set, what a shadow he left for us to see the great man that he was from these scriptures. I want to spend maybe just a few minutes here in Acts chapter 4. There are four chapters that deal with his life in the book of Acts especially. You really could expand it to more, but four that show us something different about him. And in each time he used something different to encourage someone who needed it. Acts chapter 4, let's read verses 36 and 37. Observe first, Barnabas encouraged others with his generosity. Barnabas encouraged others with his generosity. And let's read 36. And Joses, who by the apostles was surnamed Barnabas, which is being interpreted the son of consolation, a Levite, of the company of Cyprus, having land, sold it, and brought the money, and laid it at the apostles' feet. Now, the background of this, of course, is the first section of the book of Acts where Christians had been converted from Judaism. They had come to Jerusalem to participate in the Feast of Pentecost. And they had intended just to go home at the end of that week, but because they had learned of Christ as the Messiah, they had become a part of the church. The apostles were stationed in Jerusalem, and so many of them stayed over, and they just continued to gather together and to study and to praise God. And so their funds that they had allotted for this trip soon ran out, and they were at a loss on how they were going to support themselves. Some of them perhaps were able to get jobs if they had some kind of a talent that was easily, they could find a job easily in an urban area. Others of them probably were farmers and maybe did not have the kind of trade or kind of training that would allow them to get a job. And so other Christians in the group began to help them. And after a while, that money from the pocket or the wallet ran out. And that's where you are here in chapter 4, where you have now we're down to a more serious kind of commitment. I'll come back to that thought in a minute, but I want to build up to it by reading with you briefly, analyzing verse 36 to see what we know about this man we call Barnabas. That's actually his nickname, of course. His name is Joses, and he was a Levite. He was of the tribe of Levi, but that's different than the other tribes. You might say someone's of the tribe of Issachar or Judah, and that wouldn't really have anything to do with what his job was. But in the case of Barnabas or a Levite, that was what their job also consisted of. They were the tribe that was allotted to giving the priest the assistance that they needed in carrying out the worship of God. So here is a man that would be roughly the equivalent of a deacon in modern times in the church, or maybe like a Bible teacher. The priest would have been more like the preacher, but Barnabas doubtless was a teacher of the law in some capacity as a Levite. He was not from Judea. He was from Cyprus. Cyprus is an island out in the Mediterranean Sea, but it had a large colony of Jews that had migrated there, and they had a synagogue there. So that seems to have been his job before he became a Christian. Of course, he gave up teaching the law in the synagogue at that point. Matthew Henry thinks in his comments that Barnabas could have been one of the 70 who had been sent out earlier, and therefore the apostles knew him, knew of his character. And then we come on the scene here in Acts chapter 4, and we learn more about him after they already had built up a relationship with him and knew him well enough to assign him this nickname of Barnabas. The son of consolation. It's the same idea that you find in John chapters 14, 15, and 16, where Jesus said, I'm going to leave you, but I'm going to send the Holy Spirit, who will be a comforter to you, speaking to the apostles. So Barnabas was going to be a comforter to those. He was known for his comfort, so they nicknamed him Son of Consolation. He was an encourager. And I wonder, just as an aside, if someone was going to nickname us like the Indian tribes, I understand at least some of them would wait until a child was old enough that they could observe his character before they gave him a name. I wonder if I were being named as a Christian, what my nickname would be, or you were being named as a Christian. Wouldn't it be wonderful if others said, you know, the best nickname for you would be Son of Consolation or Encourager? It might be something negative, though, so I should examine my life and make sure that what others see in me and what I emphasize is something that would be worth spending my life doing and is valuable to the kingdom of heaven. All right, let's talk about the last part then, verse 37, having land, sold it, and brought the money. We don't know where the land was. It could have been back in Cyprus where he was from, but it seems more likely that there was land near Jerusalem that he had access to. Perhaps it was his family land from where they had originally moved, and they no longer needed it. Maybe it had been handed down from generation to generation, but now Barnabas says, well, you know, we're not Jews anymore. We're not going to be coming back for the feast of Passover and Pentecost and Tabernacles. We're not going to participate in the law of Jubilee, the year of Jubilee anymore, the 50th year when these lands would go back to their original owners. And so he sold the property and then he brought the money and he gave it to the apostles. Doubtless, because they were in charge and they were making sure that the distribution was properly made and it was fairly made, not so that there weren't any that were saying they needed something, but then they really didn't need it as much as someone else. So he brought it to those in charge and said, here, you do with it as you deem right and just, and I'll give it to God. You are in charge of the distribution of it. Now, I want to think with you about three or four verses, and then we'll move on to the next point. Galatians 6 and verse 7, James 1, 27, 1 John 3, 15 through 18. I'll read the 1 John passage with you and refer back to the others. So turn over to 1 John chapter 3, and let's read together. If you and I want to be the kind of encourager that Barnabas was, if we have discretionary funds, then that's one way that we can be of encouragement to other people. You think about if you had been in Jerusalem, you brought your family, you know, you had been pretty frugal with buying food and paying for your lodging. Maybe you had crammed into a smaller space so you could stay longer. Maybe it's a little bit out of town, not as premium a property, and now you're not eating any meat, you're just eating barley or the cheapest thing you can buy. But even still, you're about to run out of money and you don't want to go home yet because you don't feel like you know enough to start the church back where you're going to be. You really want to stay with the church and continue to praise God for the salvation you've received, and so it begins to weigh on you. What am I going to do? And really, how are we even going to get home? We've spent all our money here, and now we have to make our way a journey maybe of a week. How are we going to survive? And that would have been weighing on your mind, especially as the parents of children. And then there's Barnabas. Barnabas maybe overhears a conversation between a husband and a wife, just something along the lines of what I just said. And he knows that this family is really struggling, and he thinks, you know, maybe he reaches into his pocket, but there's no change in his pocket. He's already given that. Maybe he reaches into his wallet and he opens that up and, you know, there's no extra money there. And so he thinks, well, what am I going to do to help? You know, there's four levels, those two that I just noticed, and then we could go to our bank account, couldn't we? We could pull out our checkbook and we could write a check and give it to someone that would be more money probably than we carry on our person. But you know, there's a fourth level, and that's the level that Barnabas got to here, where we actually say, you know, I could sell something, and then I could give that money for this project or this person or this need. I don't really need, I can do without this property or this house or this car, this boat, these golf clubs, or this collection of whatever it is that I have put in my basement or in my closet. There are things that we might say, you know, this is not as important to me as being able to help this person who has a need or in getting the gospel to this particular part of the world. Now, here in 1 John chapter 3, I know that we know these verses, we read them, but sometimes we need to read them with fresh eyes as if we don't know them and let it just wash over us and think how this applies, not in general to somebody else somewhere else, but how it applies to me at my house and my situation. So let's all do that as if we've never read it before. Let's begin in 1 John 3, 15. This is going to be the negative contrasted with the positive. 15, whosoever hateth his brother is a murderer. Now that's really strong language, but you see how God views hatred in the heart. The only difference is that there hasn't been the opportunity for there to be hatred in the hand, but hatred in the heart leads to hatred in the hand or murder. So that's how God classes it. And you know that no murderer hath eternal life abiding in him. Now, I don't want to be that person. I ought to be very careful, though, that I dismiss that out of hand and say that could never happen to me. Because if I allow hatred to lodge in my heart and to muse upon it, then it may well be that there are many people in the prisons throughout the land tonight who never intended to be murderers, but they gave way to anger, and that's what happened. So we should be very careful to guard the gate of the heart and not just the hand or the ultimate means of murder. 16, now by contrast, hereby perceive we the love of God, because he laid down his life. God's a giver. God sent His Son. He died for it. Jesus is a giver. And we ought to lay down our lives for the brethren. You see, that's the opposite of being a murderer, is being willing to be murdered for the other person or willing to die for the... You see that contrast there? Now, if a person loves the church or loves other Christians, loves another person enough to say, I will die for you. I will take a bullet for you. I will put myself in harm's way that you survive. I would die for you. Now, if we make that kind of commitment, then the rest of these verses are going to seem like no big deal. But if we don't have that kind of love, then these other verses may be more challenging to us. And of course, that's the kind of love that we build to, we grow to. It's not a natural love, but it is the kind of love that we can possess as we develop into the mind of Christ. But whoso hath this world's good, that is, material blessings, food, clothing, shelter, all those kind of things, and seeth his brother have a need, and shutteth up his bowels of compassion. That's an old way to say he just closes his heart. He turns his eyes the other way. He pretends not to notice. He makes an excuse. He shutteth up his bowels of compassion from him. How dwelleth the love of God in him? I mean, he says he has the love of God, but God would do something about that. And so, if he doesn't do something about that, then does the love of God really dwell in his heart? My little children, let us not love in word, talk a good game, or neither in tongue, but in deed and in truth. James 1:27, pure religion undefiled before God and Father is this, to visit the fatherless, the widows and the fatherless in their affliction, and to keep yourself unspotted from the world. So for religion to be true religion, pure religion, it has this aspect, this component part of visiting. That includes what some of us did today as we went over to the nursing home and we spent some time with the residents there. We sang with them and stayed, got there and visited a little before, a little bit after. Some of you may have gone down to some rooms and sat with them afterward. I know you do that. Some, that's one thing, to visit. That's some of them, that means an awful lot. But visit doesn't just mean what we use the word visit to mean. It means also to see to the needs of. So they needed someone to talk to them. That's visiting. But they might also, on another occasion, need someone to provide a meal for them or clothes for them or to make a house payment for them or something like that. So if we have this world's goods, then we can make a difference in someone's life and we can be a Barnabas just by saying, I'll take care of that. Or we may do it behind the scenes like the Josephs did here when he said, we might go to the elders and say, you know, I sold some property and I know this family has a need. I don't want any credit for it. Their house burned or there's a recent divorce and the funds are really tied on one party or the other and I don't know how she's going to make it. Well, would you see to it that they're helped? No one will ever know that except the elders and God. But oh, what good you might do for that person in saving that soul. Even, it might not be a Christian, it might be somebody that because the church reached out to them at a vulnerable and difficult time, it opened the door to a Bible study and then ultimately to becoming a member and being saved from sins. I thought about Christopher Columbus in late 1491, early 1492, he began going to different kingdoms asking for funds for a trip to the New World. He had been to Italy, Portugal, finally came to Spain and talked to King Ferdinand. King Ferdinand said, no, we don't have the money. And he left despondent. And as he got out of town, a rider approached from behind, a messenger, and he was summoned back to the court. And when he arrived, Queen Isabella said, I will sponsor this trip. I will sell my jewels for you to make this trip. And so the trip was financed, launched, and as we say, the rest is history. But what difference a little money at the right time made in the history of the world. And on a smaller scale, a little money at the right time can make a real difference in someone's personal life. Let's move on and talk about another. Let's go in Acts chapter 9 and observe a second instance. Barnabas encouraged with his generosity. Now let's see Barnabas encouraging with his acceptance. This is after Saul of Tarsus has been converted, just after that. You remember well that story, I suppose, at least many do, where you have Saul of Tarsus, the enemy of the church. He's leaving the south and going up north. He's even going to cross into another nation of Syria and go to Damascus. And there he has authority from the chief priest to arrest those who call upon this name, the Christians. And as he's en route, he has this heavenly vision. He sees the Lord on the way. And who art thou, Lord? I'm Jesus whom thou persecutest. Hard for thee to kick against the pricks. Lord, what would thou have me to do? Go into the city. It will be told thee what thou must do. And he prays for 3 days. Doesn't eat. Finally, Ananias comes. Now, why tarriest thou? Arise and be baptized. Wash away thy sins, calling on the name of the Lord. That's Acts 9 and Acts 22, where he later tells the story, where he includes the words the preacher used for him or to him. Well, then he eventually comes back to Jerusalem. Let's just pick up the story. Verse 23, and after that many days were fulfilled, the Jews took counsel to kill him. So he went from being their hero to being their enemy. And so they said, well, just, you know, Saul killed Christians, we'll kill Saul. And so his life is in danger. Their laying in wait was known to Saul, verse 24, and they watched the gates day and night to kill him. The disciples took him by night, let him down in a down by the wall in a basket. And when Saul was come to Jerusalem, so now he's coming back home, but he's not going to go back to the chief priests or the Pharisees or any of the Jews. Well, they already know about his turncoat from their perspective. They know that he's now their enemy. And so he doesn't go to them, but he's almost like a man without a country. Because the Jews don't trust him because he turned against them. But the Christians don't trust him either because they think that it may be some kind of a trick. They think, you know, he's just trying to spy on us. He's just trying to be an informant against us. He's going to come in here and see who all the Christians are. And then they're going to show up and arrest all of us. I mean, that's what was going on in the context. Men and women were being held to prison. And Stephen had already been killed. So this was a very dangerous time to be a Christian. So they are understandably standoffish from Saul. And when he gets to Jerusalem, he can't go back to the Jews. They won't have him. And they'll kill him. But the Christians won't have him either. So here he is, a man without a country. Well, what's going to take place here is Barnabas is going to step into that gap. The word consolation or encourager literally comes from a word that means to come alongside, to come up beside someone. And that's what we're going to see him do here. The disciples, verse 26, were afraid of him, believed not that he was a disciple, but Barnabas took him and brought him to the apostles. I think that's very interesting that the apostles, there's two ideas there. One is apostles didn't know for sure if he was, they were also participants in this shunning of Saul, or perhaps they were at another location and Paul and Saul was brought by Barnabas to them because they were in charge, and thus he brought them eventually. Then they would in turn tell all the Christians it's okay because the Christians trusted the apostles. That second is probably more likely. But none of the apostles stepped in and took Saul aside, but Barnabas did. But Barnabas took him and brought him to the apostles and declared unto them how he had seen the Lord in the way, how he had spoken to him, how he had preached boldly at Damascus in the name of Jesus. Now, we don't know how Barnabas knew that. It may be that Barnabas had been in Damascus at some point and actually seen it and then headed to Jerusalem ahead of Saul. And so he was able to say from eyewitness testimony. It may be that he had talked with someone that he knew from Damascus and had firsthand knowledge of someone who had seen it and known of it. It may be that he had received letters from Damascus, or he could have even known Paul. One commentator I read said that it's possible that he had gone to school with Paul at the school of Gamaliel, or maybe somewhere else they had known each other. They had both been in the same religion, of course, probably about the same age. So it's possible that that had taken place, and thus when he saw Paul, they already knew each other, had a personal relationship, and when he told him, he believed what he said. He knew he was telling the truth. But at any rate, here is Barnabas. However he knew it, what he knew, what he said was accurate, and he stood up for Paul. For Saul, and he took his side. He accepted him. Now I want to think about how this applies to in the church today. If you don't mind participating here, I'll get you to raise your hand. If you do, then it's okay if you don't want to. But if you have ever gone, moved your membership or moved to another congregation, would you raise your hand? Keep them up just a minute. Everybody look around and see that practically 95% of the members of this audience tonight did not grow up in this congregation. Do you remember how you felt the first time you came in? And maybe you sat in the back or you sat something, did you feel awkward? Did you feel a little uneasy? Did you feel trepidation? Did you wonder, what are they going to do? What are they going to say? Are people going to like me? Did anybody speak to you? Have you ever been visiting, let's just say, on a trip, maybe a vacation or business trip, and you go into a congregation, you sit down, and it's not like you're invisible, and nobody talks to you, and nobody greets you, and nobody says, we're so glad you came today, and nobody... If you've ever had that experience, then it doesn't feel very warm and welcoming. It's not how the church is supposed to be. I said that to make this application. That's where Saul was. Saul was trying to become a part of the congregation, and they didn't want him. They said, no, you can't be a member here. So he was being shunned. Some of you, I'm not going to ask you to raise your hand, but some of you have a different experience that also plays into this. If you have been baptized, become a member of the church in your adult life, then you became a member of this congregation. Maybe in other congregations, but you're here now. Do you remember how it was? You were excited, but at the same time, you didn't really know, how can I get involved? What am I supposed to do? Am I supposed to go to this? Is it okay for me to be here? Or am I in somebody's spot? Or you remember the uneasiness that you felt as a new member, especially as a new member of the church that doesn't have background in knowing how we do things? At least if you grew up in another congregation, you generally know what the terminology means and you know generally what's going on. But someone that's come from outside, that's even more of a challenge. And so I'm saying all that to say that we as members need to remember how that felt. We need to remember, when we see someone come in, it's like they're wearing a tag or a sign that says, I'm new here, I feel uncomfortable. And you say, I see your side, I'm going to go and make you feel, it's my job to make you feel comfortable. Here's a new Christian, recently baptized. It's my job as one of the members here to make sure that this Christian stays faithful and becomes a part of the church, that they're acclimated to this congregation. They find somewhere to be plugged in, and they begin to grow, use their talents, and grow spiritually. Now, we might say, well, that's the elder's job. We might say, that's the preacher's job. We might say, well, that's the deacon's job. That's everybody's job. Surely the elders, deacons, preachers, we should be leaders in whatever's going on, but every person can do that. And every person should do that, especially if you have some connection with them or if you're in the same demographic, say you have children, do they have children, or you're about the same age, maybe you went to the same school, or you have something in common, it makes it easier for you thus to be a Barnabas to that person. I remember reading about when Jackie Robinson broke the color line in Major League Baseball. I think this was 1960-something. He was drafted by Branch Rickey, Brooklyn Dodgers. And when he was on the road, there was a lot of hatred to him. Opposing teams would try to spike him as he went around. It was terrible. Hate, death threats, a lot of things. But even his home field, Ebbets Field, he was there playing a game. And he made an error, second base, and his home crowd was booing him and jeering him, and his head was just hung. And Pee Wee Reese, shortstop, walked over second base, put his arm around Jackie Robinson, and looked up at the crowd as if to say, I'm with him. Robinson later would say, that saved my career. I was going to quit. And I wonder if there aren't people like that That's an exaggeration of how one would be treated in the church, but I wonder if there aren't times when just putting an arm around someone, standing beside them, would save not their career, but their soul, when they might quit otherwise. He went on to be Rookie of the Year that year. He led his team to the World Series that same year. He didn't quit. He was an amazing man and accomplished a great deal of good in his generation and made it easier for others after him. But if it hadn't been for Reese, he might never have been able to do it. I was impressed with a number of scriptures. I thought maybe I could find, you know, one or two other verses that would say something like this. And I have a list of 10 or 20. I think this is a doctrine. It may just be a flaw in my study, but it might be that you'd also be surprised. I'm not going to read all these, but I'm going to give you some just to show how often the scriptures emphasize this. So it must be important. Receive you one another, Romans 15:7, Romans 14:1-3. The weak brother receive, but not to doubtful disputations. Matthew 10:40, he that receiveth you receiveth me, and he that receiveth me receiveth my Father which sent me. That sentiment is found in all four gospel accounts, and there's another one in Matthew. So five times Jesus is recorded as saying what I just said about receiving those that he sent would be receiving him. Matthew 18:5. Mark 9:37, Luke 9:48, John 13:20. Philippians 2:29, receive him, that's Epaphroditus, therefore in the Lord with all gladness. Romans 11:16, Romans 16:2, Phoebe, Colossians 4:10, Marcus, Philemon 1:12, Onesimus, and on the list goes. Receive these people. Receive. Don't shun them. Don't turn a cold shoulder to them. Receive them. Make them feel welcome. That is an important doctrine from the New Testament. Then let's move on to Acts chapter 11. Well, probably could do a whole sermon here, but we won't. I'll just give you this information. You could study it further on your own. But in Acts chapter 11, you have Barnabas, who is encouraging others by his exhortation, by his good words. And some of you are especially good at words. You're able to say the right thing. You're able to think of something nice or encouraging to say. And that's a gift. That's a talent. Anybody can do some of that, but some people can do a lot of it because it comes naturally or they have cultivated that grace. And you have here, Barnabas was that kind of person. And the church at Jerusalem heard about the church at Antioch. And they sent Barnabas. Of all the members of the congregation, all the apostles that they could have sent, they didn't. They just sent Barnabas. Barnabas will be good at going up there and encouraging those brethren in that good work. Now, I've thought about this. You know, Antioch was 280 miles from Jerusalem. That's a long way today. I drove to Memphis and back yesterday. That's about 600 miles round trip. I don't know what's going on in the church in Memphis, do you? I mean, if you have a friend there, a family member, maybe you know a congregation, but I'm glad when they do well, and I don't want them to do poorly in Memphis, but I'm not that plugged into them. But here Jerusalem was saying, Antioch, we need to go check on them. We need to go encourage them. We need to see if we can help out with them. Well, part of that may have been because the apostles were still stationed at Jerusalem. But Barnabas is the one who goes. He makes this long trip. And when he gets there, it says in verse 22 that the tidings of these things came to the elder, to the ears of the church which were in Jerusalem. They sent Barnabas. Verse 23, when he came, he saw the grace of God, was glad, exhorted them all. So, good words. Well, if you keep reading here, I'll just have to tell you the story because I got to go fast. But he first encouraged them. He first was not envious of their success. Some people are envious of others. You know, if something's going well for them, then they're not happy about that. They might paint a face on, but they wouldn't really genuinely, sincerely compliment or encourage them to. But Barnabas was not that kind of person. And not only that, but he exhorted them to greater faith and commitment. And then he thought about Saul. The last time we saw Saul of Tarsus, he came into Jerusalem, but the same thing eventually happened to him that happened before. the Jews found out he was there, threatened to kill him, and the Christians had to sneak him out of town, and they sent him to Tarsus. They sent him home. Go back to your people. And doubtless, Saul wanted to go back and talk to his relatives about the gospel, but that's where we last saw Saul of Tarsus was being sent home. And Barnabas thinks about him, the same guy that stood up for him two chapters ago. He thinks, you know, Saul is not too far from here. And so he takes off to Tarsus and brings Saul back to Antioch. And then Saul and Barnabas stay a whole year working together with this church, and many people were added to the Lord because of their work. The lesson there is that we can be an encourager of others by our exhortation. And then chapter 15 is, I'm skipping over several chapters, as you'll notice here. In the meantime, there has been the first missionary journey. Paul and Barnabas went on this journey together, establishing churches. And now they have this idea, Paul does, or Saul, we should go back and check on them. We should go back, not a new trip to go evangelize and establish churches in new cities, but let's go back to the same cities, the same places, meet the same people, and not evangelism, but edification. Make sure they're doing okay. Remember, Paul, as an apostle, had ability to lay hands on people and give them spiritual gifts, which was very important in the early church before they had the New Testament, so they could have assisted them in that way. And then they decide that they're going, Paul says, Barnabas, you go with me, invites him to go. Barnabas says, okay, let's take John Mark with us. Now, John Mark was younger than the other two, and he was the nephew of Barnabas. And Paul said, no, I don't want to take him. Why would Paul be against his nephew? Well, it's because chapter 13, verse 13, they took him the first time, and he went home early. We don't know why. It just says he departed at Perga and Pamphylia. It could have been he was lazy and he got tired. He was immature and just decided he'd rather do something else. It could have been he was afraid and he was a coward. And there was threats on their lives as they went from city to city. It was also a very mountainous, dangerous region. Could have been he was afraid of falling off of one of those narrow trails along the edge of a cliff. Some people think that. But for whatever reason, he went back. And when he did, he disappointed Paul to the point that Paul said, no, I'm not going to take him again. Barnabas says, yes, we got to take him. No, yes, no, yes, no, no, yes. And then they got really mad. Sharp contention between the two. And they... ultimately, what happened is, both of them, it was a deal breaker. Neither one would compromise. I mean, these are two strong, the strongest Christians in that church, you know, an apostle and Barnabas, and they're at loggerheads about this. So, finally they decide, Paul says, well, you take him and go, and I'll take somebody else, and he ends up taking Silas. And so they went different directions. They actually ended up with two missionary trips instead of one. Barnabas took John Mark to Cyprus, which is where he was from, and then Antioch, Saul took Silas, and they went and visited the church, went back to where Paul was from, basically. So ended up good came out of it, and later on, Paul admitted, 1 Timothy 4, verse 11, Colossians 4, 10, bring Mark with you, for he's profitable for me, for the ministry. So Paul saw that he had grown up, that he was still valuable later. And so they seem to have patched things up. But the lesson here, I think, is, I don't know which one's right. I've been thinking about this a good bit this week. If you ask me, you know, who was right, Paul or Barnabas, I can see both sides. If I was Barnabas, and this is my nephew, I was trying to think if it was one of my sons, you know, he could be as close to his nephew as he was a son. I'd say, you got to give my son another chance. You know, he's better now. He needs to grow from this. He'll definitely do better. My nephew, we got to take him. We can't just throw him away. He's salvageable. I could see that from one perspective. But I could also see Paul's perspective. He left them in a lurch the first time. You know, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. So Paul said, no, we can't risk it. Because we need him to be dependable. So you could see it either way. It seems like the church ended up siding with Saul or Paul because they sanctioned his trip. It seems like Barnabas just left and went back home, which was fine. But they prayed with and sent Paul on his journey. So it seems like the church may have landed on the side of Paul. But either way, observe from John Mark's perspective that Barnabas encouraged him with his forgiveness. You know, someone responds tonight to the invitation to love and the grace of God, and they say, I've sinned, I've done wrong, I want to be right. What's my attitude toward that person going to be? Maybe it's somebody who's responded before, maybe several times before. Am I going to say, well, they just can't seem to get it together, or they don't really mean that, or they wouldn't keep going, or, well, he did something really bad, I don't know about that, or am I going to have an attitude of Barnabas? I'm going to come alongside, I'm going to encourage you, I'm going to forgive you, I'm going to stand up for you, I'm going to help you. Am I going to be an encourager of others? I close out with 1 Corinthians 13, verse 7. I was thinking as I was going through this that Barnabas is in the epitome of a loving Christian. And you see these four characteristics of love in these four chapters that we just covered together. Notice in 1 Corinthians 13 and verse 7, love beareth all things. Well, that's Barnabas digging deep and giving, bearing the burden of another. And then that text says, love believeth all things. He was willing to believe that Saul of Tarsus was really a Christian. He did not shun him as others did. And then we see in that text, love hopeth all things. That's Barnabas with in the chapter 11 when he went and exhorted the church. This is going great. It can go better. And then love endureth all things. That was his argument with Paul. Couldn't have been pleasant to either of them, but he didn't give up and they just continued. And sometimes we're going to be discouraged as Christians, but love endures. It perseveres. That's all that we'll talk about tonight. We'll extend the Lord's invitation. If you need to be baptized tonight, could we encourage you to confess your faith and to become a Christian tonight? Acts 2:38. If you haven't been a faithful Christian, maybe this lesson has encouraged you to start again. Would you come while we stand together and as we sing?